The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have the engine start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday night Space Show program. Tuesday night, of course, California time. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. Excellent program planned tonight to discuss space debris. More about that in just a minute. Let me do a couple of quick announcements. We're planning a full 90-minute program, but do watch the clock if you want to get an email into us or a phone call. Please do so while we're still broadcasting. That always helps, and it's always a good idea. And our toll-free number is 866-687-7223. And then for other announcements, it's a full week of programming on the Space Show, except that Sunday, being July 4th, there will be no program. So Friday will be our last program. We do have Hotel Mars tomorrow. And I will update the Hotel Mars site either later tonight or really early in the morning so you can see who the Hotel Mars guest is going to be and what the topic will be. It's about exoplanets looking back at Earth and what they may see by two researchers, and one of the researchers is going to be with us who has just published a great paper on exoplanets looking at Earth for a change. So that's Hotel Mars tomorrow, and then Friday, and then no Space Show on Sunday, and then we resume next Tuesday. So the other part is, this being Tuesday night, our newsletter is complete for the week. It's up on our website in the upper right corner. That's the website newsletter. Do check it out. All of the details of our programming are there. And in addition to the newsletter, scroll down on that website newsletter, and you will see all the programs we have planned between now and early September. But we are starting to schedule shows now for much later in September. So if you have any show recommendations, we'd love to hear from you. It always helps if you give me the contact information for the person you're recommending, preferably email, but contact information nonetheless. And many of our guests come through your recommendations, so don't be shy about it. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website very easily or download our programs. Remember, we have a store, and you get there by clicking on Pepper's picture, listening to the Space Show. Perhaps you'll find some Space Show logo wear items that interest you. There's an important Listen Live button in the upper left menu. This tells you how to listen to the live broadcast, which is what we're doing now, podcast, as well as archives off of our website. And if you need any troubleshooting for any of those formats, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and feel free to share this information with others that may be interested in listening to the Space Show. In addition, the Space Show is a 501c3 nonprofit with one ONE, Giant Leap Foundation, and we depend on listeners just like you listening to this show tonight to support us. And we certainly are very appreciative of your support. As a 501c3 nonprofit with one Giant Leap Foundation, if you're a federal taxpayer, you get to get a tax deduction for your gift, and the same is true if you're a California taxpayer. And there's a big PayPal button at the top of our homepage, thespaceshow.com. That's the easiest way to support us. But checks are welcome. Old school is always welcome. Your check should be made payable to 1 ONE, Giant Leap Foundation. It mails to Box 95, Tiburon, T as in Tom, I, B as in boy, U-R-O-N, California, 94920. And if you have any questions about any of that, please email me, and the best email address for me is drspace@thespaceshow.com. We also have sponsors, and since this is a full-length show, I will do sponsor messages later on in the program, but they do get the banner ads you see running across their homepage, which they can change as often as they want. Excuse me. And our sponsors are Northrop Grumman Space Foundation, Astrox AIAA, Moonwords Celestis, and the National Space Society. They all have a message for me to read, and again, that will come later in our program tonight. So I am very happy to introduce the Space Show listeners for the very first time. Alfred, and I hope I get your last name correct. I'm not great with names, but Anna Zadwa. And if I butchered it, I apologize.
Pretty close,
okay. And he's a retired U.S. State Department diplomat and 30-plus-year veteran of space advocacy. As a Foreign Service officer, he carried out diplomatic and science environmental work primarily in Latin America, the Caribbean, and Washington, D.C. Since he left the State Department, he has authored more than 40 papers and articles on space development and held various leadership positions within the National Space Society. He continues as a member of NSS Policy Committee, the International Committee, and the Board of Directors. However, for this Space Show program, he's expressing opinions that are his own and not the opinion of the National Space Society or any other organization. And after having talked with him for several weeks and worked with him to put this show together, he has strong opinions. So I think you're going to enjoy listening to what Al has to bring to us. Al, welcome to the Space Show. It's great to have you on board. And I know you want to talk about space debris, which is no strange topic to Space Show listeners. But what's different about space debris? How do you see it maybe differently than what we've been hearing for 20 years without much results?
Well, first of all, thanks, David, for this opportunity to shed some light on a very thorny issue with your help and with your citizens, with your listeners' help. The thing about space debris, and I want to mention something about the terminology here. Space debris could refer to debris on the moon, for instance. And for that reason, I'm going to be talking about orbital debris.
Okay.
It's a subset, but I think it's important not to, to introduce some confusion in the terminology. So anyway, with regards to orbital debris, I think it's a very thorny issue, and the thorniest of issues. And I recently listened to what's his name, Raul, and also to Wayne White, and they both had some very good thoughts about it. I think that the problem with orbital debris is that there are so many impediments to a solution. There are legal, political, geopolitical, technological, financial, funding, educational, and even psychological impediments. So, you know, it's a vast area, but all the different impediments are connected to each other. So I would like to start with remediation, which is the same as cleanup, and you have a very sophisticated audience. So I see people outside of the space community mixing up mitigation with remediation. And I want to be clear that I'd like to start with remediation, which is cleanup of orbital debris. And the reason I would like to start with it has to do with Wayne White's urgency. I agree with him wholeheartedly about it. This is a very urgent problem, because one of the reasons is that even if we never have another launch the number of orbital debris objects is going to expand. It's going to get worse, even without a launch. But, in fact, we're going to get thousands of more launches. I saw a report the other day. I was thinking, okay, 42,000 satellites. My God, that's... I saw another report saying that if each of these companies get what they want as far as satellites, we're going to end up with 100,000 satellites in orbit. So this is, it's urgent. It's not sustainable this way. We have to do something. But the good news, there's some good news on the horizon, and this is the other reason that I want to begin with orbital debris. And I invite all the listeners, their questions and so forth. I can talk about all these other aspects, but I have to, this is just, it's, I've been worried about this for so long, and here's good news. There are two things. One which you David, you mentioned to me in an earlier phone call. Astroscale, UK, signed a $250 million agreement to develop space debris removal technology with OneWeb. That shows that people are getting serious. You will also notice that there are more and more articles now and papers about remediation. 10 years ago, when 11 years ago, when I started talking about this, I would be warned. It's kind of premature to talk about remediation. We need to focus on mitigation. Well, now you're starting to see a sea change here, and I think even the biggest news is that I heard during the International Space Development Conference on last Friday. In an interview with Rod Pyle, who I think you folks know, he was interviewing Gwynne Shotwell, the president and chief operating officer of SpaceX. And she basically said that the Starship will have the capability to clear out large debris objects. Now, I guess we have to see, but if you bear with me, David, and the audience, I'd like to give you the full quote because I don't want to say something about another company without really being very precise about it. Can I do that or not, David?
Yeah, go ahead and do it.
Okay, here it is. This is the full quote. I think Starship will be a capability where we can pull space junk out of orbit. I know it's hard. I get that. But we have done lots of hard things in the past. So I'm looking forward to leveraging the Starship system to clean up some of those old carcasses of space debris that are really in the way of operational orbits, especially those that are kind of on the highway for human travel. So I think that's very good news. Like I said, I can go on to all kinds of other things, mitigation, whatever, space salvage, and so forth. But I think if you want to... react to that first or have the audience do so, I'm happy to just pause here.
A couple of points.
Sure.
To be
sure.
Specific, you're mostly this evening talking about low Earth orbit. Is that correct?
Not entirely. Yes, mostly about low Earth orbit because that's where, the 34,000 trackable objects are, and the over million untrackable ones. Yeah, but the big plans we have, for instance, for space solar power, where are they going to be? Well, I've seen some ideas for putting them in sun synchronous, but most of the ideas, they want them in geo, 36,000 kilometers up, in altitude, approximately. So, I mean, these would be very big products out there, objects, very easy to hit in space. And let's face it, in geo, yes, it's true that the relative velocities because they want to track with the Earth are lower, but there's still upper stages up there. There are still satellites that are defunct, and they're large. So I think, you know, we can't forget about GEO.
Okay, another quickie is when Gwen offered that quote, did Rod, I guess they didn't take questions from the audience, but did Rod or did she elaborate on just how Starship was going to remove junk in orbit?
No, she didn't. I mean, I fell out of my chair when I heard this, but there were a lot of other things that she was talking about vis-a-vis Starship. For instance, point-to-point navigation. And she implied that would be even on the Earth, but she also said in space, in cislunar space. So, I mean, they're basically, you know, she mentioned Starlink, but I can say anybody that's listening now can also listen to that whole interview. All you have to do is go to, it's on YouTube, and it's the International Space Development Conference 2021, and this was on June 25th, last Friday, but it was 3 days.
Right.
And as you know, Rod's a very good interviewer, and so she covered a number of items where she thought Starship was going to be involved and also Starlink. And, you know, I think it behooves us. I had to listen to it 3 times to really absorb it all. If it were any other company, you would think, this is magic wand time, you know. But, SpaceX basically has this philosophy is fail and renew, fail and renew, fail, you know, and learn, renew. They depend on failing, and that's their great tactic. They fail until they succeed. Failing does not stop them. And I know I sound like a groupie right now, but let's face it, SpaceX, Elon Musk has basically revolutionized the scene is completely different now than it was even 10 years ago because of SpaceX. Now you have competition, international competition. People, oh, yes, we can land rockets too. Well, before everybody was saying, well, you know, this is really hard. This is, you know, I don't think any private company could do that, et cetera, et cetera. It's a lot of naysayers.
Al, let me go back here.
Sure.
If you're going to pursue remediation, so we're talking about getting rid of junk.
Yeah.
You've already mentioned when we started the show some of the challenges, some of the barriers. I mean,
sure.
from legal to who the hell
sure.
knows what. What's the plan? What's the process? What do you do first? What do you do second? Who is in charge of organizing this?
Yeah.
Is anyone taking a lead, or is this just more BS rhetoric that everyone knows there's a problem, but
yeah.
you know, there's a lot of Indians, but no chiefs here.
Yeah. You know, I just want to say, I think we are responsible.
Who is we?
The space community.
Okay.
Everybody listening here, you and I, and the rest of us, we just can't wait for someone to appear with a magic wand. And there are no magic wands. We don't have it. No one has it, right?
Right.
So what do we have? We have ideas. We have ideas. One of the best ideas, I mean, there are funding issues, but let me get to an idea that Colonel Peter Garrison has.
Okay.
He believes, and I believe also, by the way, I have very few good ideas myself, but I like to think that I harvest good ideas from others. And Peter is one of these people. He came up with this idea of a space salvage entity. And the idea behind this entity is that it would be a platform for remediation, remediation in various ways, deorbiting, refurbishment, salvage, and reuse. In other words, you know, here we have a problem. We have 8,000 tons of orbital debris. So, and a lot of it is big and a lot of it is little. Let's start with the big stuff for sure. I mean, let's not ignore the little stuff, but of course, but if we can just start removing, you know, three or four really big, you know, school bus size items first, that's going to really help, because those items eventually will collide with each other or break up. So let's do this. And here's the other thing. It's got to be international. There's no way. Well, let me back up. The mass of this 8,000 mass of orbital debris plus really, it comes from launches from Soviet Union and Russia, United States and China. So there's no way to really solve this unilaterally. And for commercial, if you're talking about commercial companies involved, it's not fair for them. They need a level playing field. You know, Wayne White was talking about regulations, and I guess it was Rao also was talking about regulations. Regulations can be either enabling or disabling. I think it was Wayne White that kept talking about enabling regulations, enabling laws. So within that context of enabling agreements and regulations, Peter has come up with this idea of a space salvage entity. Now, so the idea is that spacefaring countries would voluntarily establish this entity in compliance with the Outer Space Treaty. And this platform, this entity, would assume jurisdiction and control, ownership, authorization, continuing supervision of unclaimed objects and some claimed objects. It would license and contract commercial entities to refurbish, rehabilitate, deorbit, and or salvage space debris. After all, it doesn't matter. To get remove space debris, if you can make it controllable, if you can make an upper stage controllable, like NanoRacks wants to do with their program, and use it for something, for a workshop in space or whatever, really, what you're doing is you're removing orbital debris. It's no longer an uncontrolled orbital debris object. But some things would need to be deorbited. So the other thing that the space salvage entity would do would look to maritime salvage custom and law and practices. And this is something that Wayne White also talked about. And I have to say that, add to what Wayne said, that this goes back, there's a very, very long tradition going back to the Phoenicians, Greeks and Romans about salvage. And yes, it did become codified. This tradition became codified of salvage going out there and then commercially getting rewarded for something, for salvage. It did get codified in 1989 with the International Salvage Agreement, which Wayne talked about. But it had been going on for centuries and centuries before that. So that's one thing I think is, you know, really, really important to do. But there are other things. So funding is a big problem, too. So
you have a note from listener Todd by email in San Diego.
Sure.
And said to have this salvage platform, then you're going to require not just the countries involved, but also the companies that launched it because they have liability, to give up their liability or to sell their liability? Or what if they think there's still commercial value with their product? Why would they just turn it over to another entity?
Okay. Here's the reason: to get rid of the liability. Okay, so let's back up a little bit. It is within the Outer Space Treaty. It is, you can sell or transfer a satellite or a spacecraft. It's already been done. It was Britain that did it with two satellites to Hong Kong, to China. And I believe a few years later, there was another one that the UK was involved with Sweden, where they sold a satellite. Okay, so when you do that, the receiving entity becomes responsible according to the Outer Space Treaty. And if you look at, Article 6, Article 7, liability passes, okay? So it's not just supervision and control and authorization, it's liability as well. And then if you look at the liability convention, I think it's 4 and 5 articles, it shows that, yes, liability can attach to all the players. However, I think it's Article 5, it might be 4, but in the liability convention, but one of those also explains that you can come up with an agreement for liability apportionment. And that is exactly the same thing that the International Space Station has used. They have a clause in their agreement with among all the nations that are involved that it's a liability waiver. And so what I'm getting at is that this is not like magic. There are mechanisms here that are congruent with the Outer Space Treaty and the Liability Convention. So, but the thing is that it's got to be done through agreements. And I want to say something else about Wayne White in this regard. He mentioned that this would not be a treaty-first way to go, and I totally agree with that. As a former diplomat, I can tell you that if you start, there are several things wrong with going that route. I don't want to just did I answer your question before I go down?
Yeah, I mean, the only other question I would add to that is anybody actually taking action on this, or is it just an idea floating around?
It's just an idea floating around.
Okay.
But ideas have consequences. So especially if, enough people promote them. And I think that, within the military, Peter Garrison is promoting this idea. I'm doing it outside of the military. Peter and I and others, I'm still involved in the National Space Society Policy Committee, and we have put out a policy paper about this. So I think this is just, there are other good ideas out there. I'm not saying this is the end and be all, but I think the more we as space activists promote these and push these ideas, eventually some sort, something will eventually come of it. We can just sit back and complain, which it seems like most people were doing about Orbital 3 for a long time. Or we can propose, we can write, we can push these ideas. So I was going to get on to something else as well, I forgot it.
You need a pencil and paper.
What was that?
So Does Peter know, has he ever gotten any feedback from launching companies, or as well as maybe China or Russia indirectly or directly, as to what they think of that kind of an idea?
I honestly don't know. I don't know. I think a lot of us feel like people crying in the wilderness. I really don't know. I can tell you with regards to China, though, and this here, this is not, I'm not speaking for NSF here.
Yeah.
This is my own opinion.
Uh-huh.
There are a lot of people in space advocacy movement who are very leery of China, and they should be. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be. But what I am saying is that China cannot be ignored. We cannot, for various reasons, but in specifically about orbital debris, you know, they're the third largest mass producer. And they have, you know, in 2007, they had this anti-satellite test that still has left debris up there, you know,
yeah, well,
trackable
that,
debris and untrackable debris.
Well, they almost dumped a rocket on a... on another location a couple of weeks
ago. That's right. So what do you do in a situation like this? Does it do any good to shun a major player? Does it do any good to fuss at them? You know, there are people who will disagree with me about this. But I think you don't get better behavior by shunning. You don't get better behavior. You have to have your eyes wide open, of course, when you deal with other countries, any country. But anyway, I'm not sure I answered your question, but
I was wanting to know, you know, if there was any feedback on how the different countries or maybe companies like SpaceX or ULA or who knows, Rocket Labs might think about something like this, and that took us into it's not a wise idea to shun China. So I would not suggest shunning China either, but I certainly would not dismiss the threats that they pose to the West on many, many different levels, and we can probably just leave it at that.
I think so. We are in agreement.
Listeners, I'll say one more thing. Scott Pace, when he was on the show Sunday, got this very question. And the reason he got the question is because the person who asked it happened to be on an email list that I'm on, and an article came up, you know, calling China out. And people on the email list were saying, fear mongers, fear mongers, and, you know, we're dismissing it. And this woman asked Scott for his opinion. Should we dismiss China? Is it fear-mongering? Do we have a concern in space? And Scott gave, it was long, so, you know, it's a long answer.
Mm-hmm.
But he gave an incredibly thoughtful, and I must say probably diplomatic, although he wasn't really a diplomat, but diplomatic response. But I thought it was a good one. And, does he skirt the issue a little bit? Yes, a little bit. You know, he wasn't a hard ass on anything. But it was very thoughtful. And, you know, the bottom line is you really can't shun them, so you find some areas where you might be able to work with them, even on the Artemis Accords, despite the Wolf Agreement. You might be able, China might be able to be a contractor on something. You know, and... So you take your wins when you can, and you keep your eyes wide open, and you understand that they're a risk.
Exactly.
But that's not – so I just direct listeners to listen to the Scott Pace show from last Sunday if you want to hear a real reasoned discussion on national security, space, and China. But that isn't part of really tonight. You know, I've been doing the show for 20 years now, and space debris was one of the early topics. And I have to say the only thing that has advanced is the amount of space debris that's up there. So,
yeah.
So, you know, I've heard it all before.
Uh, I'm laughing and crying at the same time.
I've heard it all before, so why you say it's our collective responsibility, okay. But somebody's got to make a policy.
Yeah.
If it's going to be international, are they going to try to maybe do multinational between Russia, China, and the U.S.? They're going to go through the U.N.? How are they going to – somebody's got – some group, some policy wants, something has to start the damn thing. Because right now, nobody can move because of the impediments that you mentioned during the first part of the show. I don't care how good the technology is. If those impediments aren't rectified, nobody's going to move. Astroscale can have the superest vacuum cleaner ever to get rid of this crap. But if they can't do it legally, and you've got international liability and other issues, they're not going to plug in their vacuum cleaner. So, how do you start this? That's my fundamental question. How do you start it?
I think what's going to happen is that the commercial companies themselves are going to start this.
Okay.
I mean, I wish it didn't. I wish there was leadership, better leadership all around.
I
don't want to.
on every level.
Yes, on every level. But I think that we have space companies now, new space companies that want to put up thousands of satellites, and they're not dumb about this. They know there's a problem. You know, you were talking one time with Akhil about you were talking about the orbits, and there's so many orbits and so forth. Yeah, that's true. But the good orbits tend to be polar orbits. Those are the ones that people want. Not all of them, but many of them. And the good orbits are getting crowded, both with debris and with people that want to use them. And where do they cross? They cross over the polar area. So there's, you know, this idea of big space. You can throw that out the window because the competition, you know, between, I would say, 600 kilometers up to 1,000, that the competition for those good polar orbits is fierce. And I know that there are orbits also in mid-Earth, in middle-Earth orbits, mid-Earth orbits also. But I'm just saying in low-Earth orbit now.
You've got a caller waiting to talk to you now, too.
Oh, okay. Sure, let him in, because I would like to get to funding and P&I clubs.
Okay, hang on. Here's our caller. Hi, caller. Sure. Welcome to our program tonight. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall, and I'm still in Oklahoma.
Okay.
Hey, Marshall, I heard you on the other program, by the way. I remember you had two good questions. Go ahead.
Well, hopefully I can add to my repertoire here. First question comes up is, gee, what countries have come in and declared a satellite or even pieces of a satellite as space junk? So, quote unquote, like you put the trash out by the road and the company comes along and picks up the trash. Well, if it isn't trash, they can't pick it up. So has anybody ever declared anything trash?
Yes. But, okay, of the 34,000 plus trackable pieces, and by the way, that all these numbers are fuzzy. Now there's the space fence in the Marshall Islands, and so, you know, now they're going to be able to track, theoretically, much smaller pieces. But anyway, the 34,000 approximately that they're tracking, Marshall, less than half of them can be tied to a particular country.
That's actually the second half is what size is automatically declared junk.
Well, it's all junk, whether it's trackable or not. Junk, Marshall, it's junk if it can't be controlled. That's basically it. You know, people are always talking about, the 25-year rule. We can bring down the that's ignored, by the way, by a lot of, very much ignored. But even if it's not ignored, they're talking about the spacecraft themselves. Well, what about the upper stages? The upper stages are up there. So, that's junk. It can't be controlled yet. You know, and God bless NanoRacks for trying to foreseeing this as, a potential. You know, there's a lot of metal up there. There's a lot of things that can be used, but it's all potential at this point. NanoRacks is thinking about using some of this, and there are other companies also that are thinking about it. Frankly, it's all junk. Anything that can't be controlled is junk. And it's coming at, 24,000 miles per hour, and you can double that if they hit head-on. That's a sad situation. And it's going to get worse even if there are no new launches. It's going to get worse. So what's the second question? I don't know if I answered
the
first one.
Obviously, you're basically saying, is it controllable? Well, the next thing is the trash man comes along, picks up pieces, and somebody considers something valuable. What court do they go to put in a claim for the trash man hauled off valuable stuff?
Okay, there is no court. That's why we want to establish a space salvage entity, because the space salvage entity would be a platform to sell salvaged, recycled, refurbished objects at market auctions. And the space salvage entity would use liability waivers, which I just talked about, and apportionment agreements per Article 5 of the Liability Convention so that the salver, the commercial contractor, gets some liability protection. You know, you've got to give these folks some protection. If they're going to put something in salvage orbit, they're going to have to, go through higher orbits, depending on, where they start, in order to get the salvage orbit, which is above 36,000 kilometers, right? If they're deorbiting from, let's say, 900 kilometers, they're going to have to go through other orbits to deorbit. So, I think that's why. I see this as very, very important, and I just gave a talk at UN COPUS, which is the Committee on the Peaceful Use of Outer Space, and unfortunately, it had to be a remote talk, and I mentioned the space salvage entity. It's fine to do things at the UN and give these talks and whatever, but it's not fine to allow the Treaty First people, which Wayne White talked about. Okay, this is where I'm going to get opinionated. I'm not speaking from the National Space Society, but I am speaking from years of experience as both a diplomat and also someone who has represented the NSS at UN COPUS. Okay. They can argue about something, literally, two or three sentences for several days. I mean, and the people come in with that historical baggage, It's just not a forum. When you look at governance, there are two major camps. You got the treaty first camps, and you got the people, the bottom up, and I belong to the bottom up, full disclosure, that believes that you have to evolve, from best practices and from national legislation and international agreements, including very, very important the space industry involved. That's the bottom up idea. Space industry is very much involved. And and that so that's the and that it evolves into best practices, and from best practices it evolves into customary and national law, which can happen very slowly or very fast. I can give examples of both, and then from that eventually gets codified. The problem with getting a treaty first is that it becomes static. You know, and first of all, it takes a long time. It takes a long time. This is something that Wayne White talked about. It takes a long time to you know, with everybody bringing their bag, historical baggage in and fighting over every little phrase. I'm maybe exaggerating a little bit, but not much. It takes years. It takes a long time, and then once it's done, it becomes a static product. And it's very hard to amend after that. Whereas if you do it the other way, from the ground up, you can start with agreements involving space industry right away, for instance. And, you know, good examples. Now here, this has to do with the Moon Treaty. It has to do with international, with, you know, part of the test ban. Excuse me, not test ban. Let me back up a little bit. There's a way to do this without a regime, without an authority. There's this international seabed authority. It turns out that the people that came up with this international seabed authority tend to be the same people who look favorably upon the Moon Treaty. And that's not a coincidence. Okay?
Yeah, right. We talk about that a lot on the space show over the years.
I'll bet. So look at the bottom-up people. The Hague Space Sources Governance Working Group. What do they say? Do they talk about an authority or a regime? No, they don't. They talk about building blocks for the development of an international framework. Okay? Framework. So Article 13 of the Outer Space Treaty also calls for a framework. Right? That's different than a regime. That's different than an authority. If you look at Article 11 of the Moon Treaty, the word regime appears like four or five times. That's not an accident. It's the top-down treaty-first thing, you know. And same way with the International Seabed Authority, which it comes out of the UN Law of the Sea, Convention on the Law of the Sea, which is normally it's a pretty good document. But when you get to Part 11, all of a sudden you see the words regime, authority, you know, and both of them talk about forced sharing. So this is, you know, I'm kind of summarizing this, and I'm sure people who love the Moon Theory are not happy with what I'm saying. But that's my opinion.
We have others that talk about the need for bilateral or multilateral agreements, and the Artemis Accord is a good example of that.
I agree. And notice that the Artemis Accord also uses the word framework.
Uh-huh.
That's not by accident,
by the way.
That's not by accident. That is not by accident.
Marshall, anything else for you? Otherwise, I want to see if anyone else wants to talk to us.
Well, I've enjoyed it, and I do have to side with the people that basically say technology is constantly changing, and you have to go with the technology. And old bureaucrats, you know, that make treaties, you know, because they sound good, yeah, those don't work. Thank you. Good night.
Thank you, Marshall.
Thanks.
Take care. Hi. Listeners, Marshall has, as we like to say, left the stage. And if you would like to call us, it is 866-687-7223. All ideas are welcome. Give us a call. Email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. So I'm still looking, Al, for how to launch the process. How to, aside from just talking about it like we're doing tonight, how do we push the button that says the process has started? Do you have a plan? Does anyone have a plan? Does Peter have a plan?
We do. Okay, I'm going to talk about the National Space Society now.
Okay.
The National Space Society has a policy committee. I was on that policy. I'm still on that policy committee. I was the chair for a while. But, I want to do other things in my life. So I gave it up, but I'm still on the committee. And the National Space Society Policy Committee folks meet every week, and they talk about how to move people in Washington. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that the NSS is always successful, but, there's an arm of the NSS called the International Committee. I was on that, too, and also, for a while, the chair. So, and we have lawyers involved. The Michelle Hanlon, who is now the president, started off on the International Committee and went to the Policy Committee, added that. Became chair of, I think, both at one time, and now is the president of the National Space Society. So we have lawyers like her, with practical experience with contracts, for instance, as well as space law. So Scott is
Ambassador or something,
pardon,
right?
Scott Pace,
right,
is someone who knows us very well, and we have, we submit letters sometimes, and we put out these policy papers, and, what else can we do? I think we do everything we can, and now I am, not so much involved in leadership, but I'm going to do what I can from the outside. And I think that we all, it's funny because sometimes it looks like you're not getting anywhere. And then all of a sudden, the idea is an overnight success. It's not really an overnight success. It came from the years of slogging along where it didn't seem like you were getting anywhere. And we all know that this is important for the long-term survival of humanity. So what are we going to do? Sit on our hands?
I got another email for you.
Sure.
Jane is in Denver, Colorado, and she says, Al, do you have a timeline for starting remuneration work? If so, what is it?
Well, my timeline was 11 years ago, I wasn't getting anywhere. I don't have a company. I've got to persuade others to do it. But the fact that, that SpaceX suddenly is talking about remediation, about cleanup, that's fantastic. I mean, aside from the other company getting involved with this, I just think that it's evidence that we are having an impact, So, I don't, if it were any other company other than SpaceX, I would think, oh, come on. But I think, I think it's evidence that there's traction here. And you have people like Scott Pace calling for this, too. By the way, it's not an accident Scott Pace is talking about this going to DOCOSC, the Office of Space Commerce, and getting them fully funded. I think Scott and the National Space Society, and certainly I, feel like the Commerce Department for the United States is going to be more sensitive to the commercial community. There's a wonderful other office in FAA, DOT, you know, Department of Transportation,
right.
FAA. It's the AST, which
right.
is incredible. Right. So it's the Office of Commercial Space Transport, I think.
Uh-huh.
And they do great work, wonderful work. And whatever the OSC has to do, Commerce has to do, has got to be in coordination with them. But I think also Department of State and NASA, but of course, but Department of State now, there's a space office at Department of State. I used to work right across the hall from them. I was in Oceans. There's a bureau there of Oceans, Environment, and Science. And what was his name? Ken. Anyway, so every once in a while, I was in Oceans, and that's how I found out about all this maritime stuff. But I would walk across the hall, and they knew I was a space geek, and so they let me sit in on some meetings. So it was really fun. I think that space office is going to be very important now. It's already growing in importance. And you know who works with them is Gabriel Swiney. Gabriel Swiney, along with Mike Gold, they were involved with this Artemis Accords.
Right, I'm aware of that.
Yeah, so I think we're seeing some movement here. That 2 years ago I was pretty depressed about this, but I see some movement here, and so I can't do anything personally. I don't have a company. I don't have a magic wand, but Astroscale. Maybe Astroscale can. They're getting money for it. Maybe. Oh, I want to talk about. Do you mind? I'd like to talk about what might work and what might not work with orbital debris.
Okay.
Technologies.
Okay.
I think because. See, the problem, there's this clean space idea, you know, that came out of Europe. ESA. So their idea was to use fuel, go up, grab something, and bring it down. Well, that's going to be pretty darn expensive, you know? So I think that that a launch has to end up with multiple deorbitings or repairs. Otherwise, it's not going to be viable. So now why is SpaceX thinking about this? Well, because they can land and go up again, and they can also, they're thinking about fueling in space and so forth with fuel depots. So they're thinking about multiple, I am sure they're thinking about multiple debris encounters. You know, that's the only way it financially, I think, can be viable. And there's another idea about this that Jerome Pearson, I don't know if he's ever been on your show, but him and Joe Carroll have come up with this idea of an eddy, which is an electrodynamic debris eliminator. And the beauty of this, and it's only at technology level, 3 or something, because of funding. A lack of funding. The idea of it is that it doesn't use fuel. It can use the magnetic field lines of the Earth to move, push against, and to pull with. So it's basically a big ribbon in space that's also a like a solar panel, you know. It develops a current, and in low Earth orbit, until you get to 1,600 or 1,800 kilometers, before you start hitting the Van Allen belts, you can have a circuit go through with the ions that are there in low Earth orbit, and control this ribbon. Jerome Pearson can explain this very well. I can't. I'm not a physicist, but I just think there are new technologies. There's touchless technologies. The guy named Pete Schaub. The idea is to move things instead of grabbing them, which is pretty tough. You got these things tumbling around. You can move them electrostatically with a very old technology of electron gun technology, imparting more negativity on the object that you're going to, and you're more positive, that the ship is more positive, so you can pull it in almost like a tractor beam, or move it, to some extent. I mean, that's the theory behind it. All I'm saying is that all these technologies are very, very young, and it's time to get the government and also anybody else who's listening to fund them some more, because we have to do something. My suspicion is that the commercial space companies, the new space companies, are not going to wait much longer. They're already starting to have their plans to do something, because they need these valuable orbital planes, bands, to be cleared for their satellites.
Listeners, let me give out our phone number. Again, it is 866-687-7223. And email is also drspace@thespaceshow.com. Plenty of time to call or email, and we like hearing from you. What else were you going to say before I step on you?
I would like to talk about funding a little bit.
Okay.
This is all the big bugaboo, right?
Uh-huh, one of them, yes.
Okay, so, yeah, among others. Well, okay, my suggestion, I'm hoping that we can all promote to some extent, is that the commercial satellite companies worldwide proactively begin accruing trust funds via very small end user fees. So, now, this is something, I heard the Russian delegate at UN COPUS, let's see, 2 years ago, bring up this trust fund idea. I'd actually be surprised if no one's thought, if they haven't already thought about this or considering it. But, when you get a bill, let's say for, your phone or whatever, you have all these little fees, right, that are tacked on. And most of us, our eyes glaze over, and we don't even know what we're paying for. But, if you had a 2-cent fee at the end of your bill, right, it wouldn't be a big deal at all. But guess what? It would be worth billions of dollars. It would raise billions of U.S. dollars annually. A 2-penny environmental fee per dollar on satellite service and user bills. So what I'm hoping for is that, that the commercial spaceflight industry is going to be proactive here and start looking ahead. They're going to have to clear out some of these orbital bands. if they start accruing as individual companies, but also internationally, if they could do this internationally, have an international trust fund for this, it would be a great nest egg of funding for commercial. The commercial contractors they're going to need to clear the debris. So, you know, all you can do is hope that people think ahead about this. And so that's one of the thoughts I have about it. And I have another thought that comes from the maritime industry. I don't want to say that all good ideas about space come from the maritime industry, because they don't. There are some certain things, just as Wayne White mentioned, there are certain things that wouldn't work at all because of the Outer Space Treaty, basically. But one thing that would work are what they have called P&I clubs, which are protection and indemnity clubs. Okay, so who's in a P&I club? Well, first of all, what is it? It's an insurance cooperative. Okay, so it's nonprofit. So therefore, all of a sudden, it's less expensive. All right? And it's like a clearinghouse, too, for information. Who's in it? All the players. In the maritime industry, it'd be the shippers, the salvers, all the companies that are involved are in these P&I clubs. And how does it work? Well, there's a call, an annual call, where everybody divvies up a certain amount. Okay? If at the end of the year, and this call pays for, let's say that there's some accident and someone's found, one of the shippers is found liable, got to pay, the call pays for them. The fund pays for the shipper. It's protection. That's why they call it P&I, because it's protection and indemnity, right? So at the end of the year, if there's still money in the pool, then the call is less that year. If, on the other hand, they had to really put out some big bucks, they have a secondary call before the end of the year to replenish the pool. But in general, it works like an insurance company, but it covers things that an ordinary insurance company would not cover, and also it's cheaper. So I think this is something from the maritime industry that could be very helpful for the space industry. So that's what I wanted to say about funding.
Are there organizations, space companies interested in this? Are you at conferences hearing any commentary about it?
Not yet. Again, the National Space Society has put out some, and I also have put out articles about it.
But, I have another listener email. Jack is in Dallas, Texas, and Jack says, regarding your 2 cent user fee, what invoices would that be assigned to for we, the consumers?
The company would be up to the commercial company, whether it's a, satellite radio or whatever, to do it. So in other words, this is not a top-down deal. I am suggesting something that, and this was also in the article that I wrote with Peter Garrison. We are suggesting something that the commercial industry should do proactively. Now, it wouldn't have worked before. It was a bad idea before, because before all the commercial companies were in geo, right?
Right.
So, but it's different now. It's different now. You have, Starlink and other companies, going into LEO. So now LEO is becoming commercialized. So it's in their interest. We can't depend on just the government. You know how the thing is that taxpayers get tired of new taxes, and so it's a hard sell. It's a hard sell for taxpayers. You know, once there's a tragedy in space, then it's not a hard sell. All of a sudden, oh, we should do something. Why haven't we done something before? You know, that's the way human nature is. But I think I see a glimpse with what OneWeb is thinking about in SpaceX. I see, and also Nanorax is a very, that's the little engine that could, you know, there, Jeffrey Manber and Nanorax. I see them looking at this whole space orbital debris business situation with new eyes, you know? And, you know, frankly, I have some hope now, and I think they're going to pull it off before there's a tragedy in space. And what I'm so worried about is a human, an astronaut being killed in space or something like that or injured. I just, you know, please let's do something before that can happen.
You have another email.
Yeah.
Charlotte is in Wheeling, West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, I'm curious if you have ever taken your case to congressional testimony. Have you ever testified before a congressional committee on space debris and the issues? Sounds like you should.
I have not, but we have an arm of the policy committee that has. Every year. We send people out to congressional committees to talk to them. I actually have too on my own, but I think that orbital debris has been on the back burner, unfortunately, for Congress. And when we send people out, we often are thinking along the lines, and maybe I'm not the best person to talk about this. Maybe we'll need to bring Dale Scran on or somebody like that or Wainwright. But I think that very often we're looking to see where we can get something done. You know, for instance, near-Earth asteroids. We're really pushing near, you know, the NeoCam, the new camera to spot incoming uh-huh. near-Earth asteroids. If it was just up to me, I think that orbital debris would be a very high priority. But I think we have to approach that in terms of, like Scott Pace, strengthening space situational awareness and space traffic management. Okay, so we and Scott Pace believe that the Space Policy Directive 3, which calls for open architecture data repository being established by the Department of Commerce, that is indirectly gets at orbital debris. Because why? Because we are pushing that. Because if we know where things are, if we can strengthen that, you know, that's going to help us deal with orbital debris. And really, there is no space traffic management system yet. But it's got to be international. There are different, every country is doing something, but there's a long way to go. We need to connect. The various countries need to connect and swap data and plan. And there are a lot of things that can be done. There can be beacons in space that we can launch. Now I'm getting into mitigation. There are various things that can be done for mitigation, you know, so that at least you don't have so much more orbital debris. And so, you know, for instance, you can launch with a mechanism on your satellite to make it easy to service. You know, this is something the National Space Society had called for years ago. You know, there are multiple ideas for mitigation, and I think that if we depend on the 25-year rule, I mean, oh my goodness, the 25-year. First of all, that's way too long for something to be up there, uncontrolled, tumbling. Also, it doesn't address the upper stages, which are also up there and tumbling. You know, Joe Carroll, who I think I've been on your, you know.
Yeah, I know him very well, yeah.
Yes. He's got this idea about parking, that there should be a parking fee. You know, so this is similar to, I think it was Rao's idea of orbital usage fee. But I think it should be much stronger than orbital use fee. I think that if you have an upper stage up there tumbling, you're actually using that orbit. You're using that orbit. I think that the parking fee, or whatever your orbital use fee, or whatever you want to call it, it's got to be international. You don't want to make it so that only U.S. companies have to pay it. Got to be across the board. But I think it should be attached to any upper stage that you leave in orbit. Now, the Starship will be bringing even their up, will have the capacity, the way I understand it, is that they'll have the capacity to even bring down not just their boosters, but their upper stages, or leave them up and controlled for a length of time. So, you know, that's, and again, it shows that that the new space people are on the head, you know, are on the cutting edge of doing something about this.
You have another question from another listener. So this is Beth in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And Beth says, my understanding is that right now it's voluntary to whether you're going to put deorbiting devices on your satellite or whether you're going to leave enough fuel on board to control them to come back down or move them. Why does this have to be voluntary? Why can't that be mandatory?
Well, okay. It is voluntary. She's right. Okay. Why can't it be mandatory? Basically, because there's no one-world government that's going to make them do it. So what do we do? If there's a no world government to make everybody be nice and do things right, bring their garbage in. You know, there's this thing on for hikers, pack it in, pack it out.
Right.
So what do? You have to do this through multilateral agreements. And the Artemis Accords is a step forward with that, even though it's about the moon. It's that kind of agreement. Of course, those are mostly, at this stage, bilateral, but I think the door is open for multilateral agreements also. So I think you have to do this through multilateral agreements, and which involve the space industry from the get-go. So, and give some, you know, like I said earlier, there's such a thing as enabling legislation and laws and regulation, and there's also disabling regulation and laws. And if you don't have the space industry involved from the get-go, You run the danger of disabling them and having disabling regulations and laws and agreements. So, and again, this this goes back to the bottom-up idea. You know, if I think that there's got to be this bottom-up groundswell to reach all these goals that we have.
Do you have an action plan for the Space Advocate listener? What do you tell the listener to this show to go do?
Yeah, I'm hesitating because I'm getting ready to leave for Italy, and but what they could do. I am still connected to the National Space Society Policy Committee. So, and this goes for Wayne White, too. He was saying, what can we do to get, you know? All right. The thing is that I can be a conduit, you know. I won't be able to pay attention to it probably for 3 weeks, but... if you will share with them on the internet my email.
Okay, with your permission.
Yes. And if they would, the people who ask for things here, and I have to give some caveats here. Please put something at the top like concerning the space show or something so that it, because I get flooded with emails, and I have to, you know, be able to pick out the important ones.
Okay. I'll give them, put a...
Would you do that?
Yeah,
David?
A topic, space show reminder or something. Okay.
Something like that.
Okay.
And then if they can wait about, you know, a few weeks, I will get them connected to the policy committee. But let me explain something about the policy committee, and this kind of goes back to what Wayne White was asking about. The first time I wanted to get a paper with some orbital debris ideas through the policy committee, it took 9 months. Okay, so it's a committee. Okay, it's got more than a dozen people on it, and they all have opinions and. Towards the end, I was in, you know, I kept submitting papers, and I also became the chair eventually. And towards the end, I got one through in 3 weeks. Okay, so, but my point is that if you have some, like Wayne White's got, you know, his Pioneer Act. If you have something like that you want to propose, you have to, I'm willing to look at it first, perhaps, but I can tell you that you're entering a long process, and then you get, if the committee does take it, you know, they get bombarded also
right.
from all sides. So if the committee does take it upon themselves to use it as something that they push with Congress, then, you know, that's a possibility. But understand that with Congress and with most people that are not space, that don't have much knowledge about space, you have to make things simple. So, and you have to use, you know, you may submit, you know, wonderful ideas and papers, 10, 15 pages. When we go to talk to people in Congress, we have to break it down to 3 points. And then, if that catches fire, then we can submit something bigger, you know, something more, you know. And it's basically the staffers are the key people there. If a staffer happens to be interested in space, that's a great advantage for us. Great advance, but not all of them are. So it, you know, it really depends on the congressperson, the senator. It depends on the state. And understand, I wish I could give you a clearer picture, an easier picture. I wish I could give everybody, you know, a magic wand. We don't have it. But every state has a different constituency that has a different way of looking at space. You know, maybe they're working on the space launch system. You know, and there are a lot of jobs attached to that. Maybe they're in Texas near Boca Chica. And, of course, they're all about SpaceX there. So I know it sounds complicated because it is, but I'm willing to be the conduit. I ask just that you break it down as simply as you can, and we'll go from there.
Okay.
And how's that?
Fine.
That's the best I can do.
Okay. And we're pretty much at the end of the program. Do you have anything that we forgot to talk about or should have talked about, or that you want to leave us a closing message?
Yeah, I have a closing message.
I'm sure you do. Go for it.
Here's a message that I want to get through to everybody that's listening and to the people in Congress. When you're talking about orbital debris, it's pay now or pay more later. It's pay now or pay more later. And the more later is not just in money or taxes, you know. It's also in your service is not working. You go to a bank, you go to an ATM in somewhere and nothing happened. Your energy grid fails. Our modern society is tied to satellites now. You know, we can't exist without them. Banking, energy, it's all tied to, you know, aside from the whole environmental movement depends on satellites looking at the Earth and the space, checking out the sun, you know, for solar storms. So, it's pay now or pay more later. Let's get people to pay something now. That's my last message.
A very good message. So cell phones don't work either, by the way. Lots of other things won't work.
That's right.
Your cable TV's not going to work.
Yeah, how about navigation? How many people have pulled out a map lately? Remember those things on paper?
Yeah, I still use maps, but I guarantee you most of the younger people cannot read a map. Maybe a lot of the older people forgot. Even naval officers forgot how to navigate at sea. They had to go back and teach them how to do it when they were having all those collisions in the Pacific several years ago. So I guess they can do that in between all their reading lists that they're being given. It is a big risk, and because it seems pretty far off in the distance, because it's not happening now, nobody seems to feel the urgency, do they?
Yeah, it's like the Titanic, right?
Right.
It's like, you know, let's not worry about icebergs, you know.
We're unsinkable.
We're unsinkable. It's human nature. I wish it weren't so. You know, we had the two collisions that were pretty bad, you know, the one with the iridium in 2009.
Right, but then you had the Chinese ASAT test that was real horrible.
And then the AT in 2007, the Chinese ASAT, you know. But I think it was the iridium one with the Cosmos that shook people up a little bit more. But it wasn't enough. I hope and pray that it doesn't take, you know, a real tragedy before, before people wake up and realize we've got to get moving here. I so agree with Wayne White about this. We can't wait around for some treaty 10 years from now. 10 years from now is too late. It's way too late. We got to get moving.
Listeners, before we sign off, again, I overlapped the time and did not read sponsor messages, but I do want to shout out and thank our great sponsors once again, Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, and the National Space Society, which we've been talking about a lot tonight. And Also, there are banner ads that run across our homepage, which they can change as often as they like. If you're interested in being a sponsor, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Al, I want to thank you very much for being a guest. I am pretty sure we'll talk to you some more because I don't think the problem's going away anytime soon. And maybe the people that you talk with and that plug in with will have some other ideas that,
Okay, good.
You know, I like Peter's idea, too, and I know Peter quite well. I should get him on the phone to talk to him about it. So keep us posted and travel safely to and from where you are now and to and from Italy. And, you know, you can listen to the space show from Italy. You just need to pay attention to the time difference. So,
well, you've got a new fan. I ignored you for years, and I did hear Brad Blair years ago, but that was about it. But you've got now an adherent.
Did you know Declan O'Donnell?
Oh yes. Oh yes.
So you know Declan was decades ahead of everybody with his lunar governance ideas, things like Artemis and stuff. I was part of his group, and Declan, I mean, he never could put it together or implement it, but his lunar ideas are what's being acted upon today. He was, unfortunately, he's no longer with us, but he was an amazing, amazing guy he helped me with my doctoral dissertation. He helped me with the legal part of it, and he is a great friend, and his lunar governance ideas, they're only now coming into fashion. I mean,
if you ever invite me again, I'd love to talk about governance. I have some real I have some thoughts about that as well.
Well,
and,
let me know when you're back in the country from Italy.
Okay.
When do you come back?
Well, it'll be in October.
Okay,
If you want to talk about governance here, I'd love to tell you about the Lunar Development Cooperative and
you know what I'm talking about.
For all mankind.
You know what I'm talking about with Declan from years and years ago.
Oh, yeah, yes.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I only met him twice, and it was shortly before he passed away, I think maybe 2 years after the last time I talked to him with a group. Brad Blair was with me at the time.
Yeah, he was a big National Space Society guy and also a Mars Society guy. He was the attorney for Bob Zubrin at the Mars Society.
Mm-hmm.
And he published a journal which was very high quality. I even wrote articles for it. That's not why it was high quality, but it was high quality, and it was called Space Governance. And I may still have my issues someplace, but Declan, he was decades ahead of his time on lunar governance, and so I'd be happy to talk to you about that. So let me know when you're back in the country.
Will do.
All right.
And thanks so much for this opportunity, and you take care now.
Okay, and listeners, thank you for your emails, and Marshall for your call, and everybody have a great week, and the week is young, so enjoy it, and stay safe, and stay healthy, and as always, keep looking up, as we like to say, and good night from Al, David, Pepper, who has been up here with me for the entire show, being very polite and quiet, and all of you. Once again, good night from the Space Show, and really do stay safe and stay healthy and well, and come back for more programs. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.